think that the most important achievement of elites is to persuade people that they don't have power. What happens if all the nannies in the country decide that they'll stay home?
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Practical Radicals podcast. I'm Deepak Bhargava.
And I'm Stephanie Luce. We're excited to be back today to talk about disruption with our guest, the legendary scholar activist Frances Fox Piven. We touched on the strategy of disruption in episode 3 when I spoke with Greg Nomaker of SEIU Local 26. Greg told us about how the union has been digging into base building for many years in order to lay the groundwork for successful strikes. I'm thrilled to report that thousands of workers have settled tentative agreements and won real victories over the last few weeks in Minnesota.
New this morning, a tentative agreement has been reached between SEIU janitors and their employers. This is following the historic strike this past week. Workers struck at over 100 buildings, marched and held a rally. The tentative agreement includes instant pay increases to $20 an hour, employer-funded retirement and life insurance, increased sick days and holiday expanded union protections, and much more.
This week, we're going to continue our discussion of disruptive power and disruptive movements.
In episode 2, we explained that disruptive power is the power to shut things down, or what the sociologist Luca Perrone calls the power to wound. We can see that in many labor strikes when workers stop production and as a consequence, employers stop making profits. And we saw it in episode 1, when civil rights leaders in Birmingham, Alabama, launched a campaign that included a consumer boycott and mass protests in the downtown business district that threatened the profits of white business owners. This campaign, called Project C, forced the business owners to agree to desegregation in 1963. Reverend Wyatt T. Walker, the architect of Project C in Birmingham, had done the math figuring out how many protesters would it take to shut down businesses and how much of the black community would have to participate in a sustained boycott to threaten the rate of profit of white business owners. So those are some classic examples, but most campaigns aren't actually disruptive. Stephanie, can you remind us what makes some actions disruptive and others not?
So disruption takes place when underdogs stop the functioning of an oppressive system to create an economic or moral or political crisis and force overdogs to meet their demands or at least make concessions. It's important to distinguish disruption from protest. Protests are usually noisy, but they're not always disruptive. So, for example, millions of people across the U.S. took part in the women's marches to protest the election of Donald Trump the day after his inauguration. But it didn't force Trump to give up the presidency. And in February of 2003, between 6 and 10 million people in 60 countries protested the planned U.S. invasion of Iraq, making it the largest protest event in human history. But just over a month later, the shock and awe attack on Baghdad began. These kinds of protests may serve other purposes. They may help shift the narrative, dramatize the injustice, or they may strengthen bonds between members of a group. But unless they stop a system from functioning, they're not using disruptive power. There's a lot of evidence that in recent years, protests by themselves have been less effective in achieving change. That's why disruption is so important for underdogs to use right now. So protests are noisy, but not usually disruptive. And disruption is not always noisy.
Right. This is such a key distinction. One of the most strategic uses of disruption in American history was what W.E.B. Du Bois called the general strike of enslaved people during the Civil War. A vast number of enslaved people withdrew their labor, and they left plantations stealthily by sneaking away. There were no public demonstrations, and yet this loosely coordinated action, led and organized by enslaved people themselves, was a key factor in breaking the system of slavery. It was deeply disruptive. So disruption is really powerful, but it rarely works as a strategy on its own.
Yeah, in some cases, workers are located in strategically important positions, and they're able to strike and win demands on their own. But even in these cases, they need to have solidarity power. They need to have each other's backs on the picket line, and they might need community support to prevent the employer or government from crushing the strike. But in many cases, underdogs don't have enough power to win on their own, so they try to create the conditions for disruption to spread virally, moving a disruptive act into a disruptive movement.
We can see examples of disruption in the women's strikes and sex strikes that have occurred throughout history. For example, on a day known as the Long Friday in 1975, 90% of women in Iceland took part in a general strike called Women's Day Off, and they won an Equal Pay Act the following year. And in our book, we tell the story of how welfare rights movement leaders like Johnny Tillman and Beulah Sanders disrupted welfare offices in the 1960s and 1970s and forced them to start paying thousands of women of color the benefits they were entitled to but had been denied due to the racist practices of the system.
Disruptive movements have some common elements. They mobilize powerful emotions, anger at injustice, and perhaps hope for an alternative. Underdogs disrupt when they break rules and norms by stopping work or breaking the law or simply refusing to cooperate. One of my favorite examples is Standing Rock, where Native leaders and allies, under the slogan, "Water is life," actually put their bodies on the line and for a time successfully blocked the construction of a pipeline that would poison people and the environment.
For months, Standing Rock advocates calling themselves water protectors have camped out around the construction site through tear gas and blizzards. The Standing Rock Sioux tribe has called this land home long before it was renamed the state of North Dakota. Standing Rock supporters face down law enforcement over remaining in what they say is a sacred site.
While some disruptive acts can win with a relatively small number of people, disruptive movements need mass participation.
And it's important to note that while organizers can't manufacture a disruptive movement, they can lay the groundwork that makes it more likely that it'll emerge and spread by cultivating leaders, by shaping demands, and sharpening their analysis of the vulnerabilities in a system. This work can also help sustain a movement once it's begun. Organizations can undermine upsurges by trying to control or co-opt them, trying to negotiate deals on their own. Or they can fan the flame, spreading the action to new areas and organizing support for people taking risky actions. The Movement for Black Lives did this by organizing bail funds that made it less risky for protesters to take action. And communities and workers often organize strike funds to cushion the loss of income during a strike. This dynamic between organizations and disruptive movements is a really tricky one because it means the movements are decentralized and no one person is in charge. But ideally, the actions are coordinated with shared leadership and vision.
Disruptive movements have had huge impacts, and they tend to be the things we remember most when we think about transformative change, like the 1937 Flint sit-down strike or the civil rights sit-ins. These disruptive movements resulted in real gains, and they also helped form new organizations and leaders. Many people who participate in these movements become leaders in social change for the rest of their lives.
But disruptive movements are hard to pull off. They rely on good planning, but also some degree of luck. And how overdogs respond is a big, big factor in their success or failure. Many workers' strikes have been crushed. But the 1937 Flint strike wasn't because there was a governor in Michigan who was sympathetic to labor. Disruptive movements are also not sustainable for the long term. We can't just engage in mass protest all the time. People get burnt out, they run out of money, they get arrested, and the risks are really high. People have even lost their lives engaging in this kind of strategy.
It's also important to remember that overdogs can use disruption too. It's not just a strategy for underdogs. We saw that with the insurrection on January 6, 2021. And 20 years earlier, in the aftermath of the 2000 election between Al Gore and George W. Bush, scores of young Republican staffers were flown to Florida to try and disrupt the counting of ballots. This action became known as the Brooks Brothers riot, and it spurred the Miami-Dade Canvassing Board to end a manual recount of ballots that could have put Al Gore in the White House.
What you're witnessing there ultimately shut down the recount right here in Miami, and it never started up again.
And employers disrupt all the time, too. For example, by calling in law enforcement to violently suppress workers' protests or picket lines, by firing striking workers, or by moving jobs overseas.
One of the people who has taught Stephanie and me the most about disruption is Frances Fox Piven. Frances has written extensively about disruptive movements, including her book, Poor People's Movements, and she was our colleague at the City University of New York. She's known not just as a scholar, but as an activist, playing an important role in the welfare rights movement, and with her late husband, Richard Cloward, championing efforts to register low-income voters of color. In fact, it was Frances who recruited me to work at CUNY. Stephanie and I knew that we wanted to have a conversation with Frances for this podcast. We asked her to reflect on the themes of her scholarship and her activism and talk a bit about her own amazing life journey. So, Frances, an important idea that you've developed is the idea of interdependent power, which you argue is key to the gains that oppressed people have made through history. Can you say more about what that is?
Sure. Well, most of the writing about power and power resources treats resources as almost like things or attributes. So power resources are money, or power resources are factories, or power resources are positions that demand respect. Those are power resources. And we can trace how those power resources affect human relations, giving some people power and forcing other people to be obedient. There's some truth to that, and it, for some purposes, it works all right. It's true that the rich have more authority than the poor and stuff like that. But that point of view misses a lot. And what it misses is the power we need, the power that ordinary people have. It misses the fact that everyone has power. Everyone has power in a society, by which I mean people who are interacting and depend on each other because of the interactions and what the interactions can produce. Everyone in households, families, schools, factories, everyone has potential power. That is the most important credo, I think, for organizers. Everyone has potential power because those who are thought to wield power in society depend on everyone. Everyone has to stop the car at the red light. Everyone has to cross the street at the crosswalk if it's going to work. Everyone has to get on the elevator in a certain way. Now, I think, and I sort of want to laugh when I say this, I think that the most important achievement of elites is to persuade people that they don't have power, that they can only bow their heads, give in, and so forth. But just think about it. If they won't cross the street at the intersection, if they won't come to work in the morning, what happens if all the nannies in the country decide that they'll stay home?
Yeah, so, well, going on that idea, you know, a lot of people think major social change happens because politicians in power change the laws or make a smart decision. But really what you're saying here is that major change happens from below. That really leads to your idea that major change doesn't happen because smart people are in office, politicians make changes to laws. But in fact, change happens when people disrupt the system
well,
and stop
no,
it from happening.
Wait a minute. What kind of change? obviously, change is continuous. It's happening all the time. And most of the change that has molded our society has been motivated by the people at the top. But change that increases social justice, change that reflects the aspirations of ordinary people, that does not happen unless people recognize this power. Now, here is what I think is a very important point. Most of the time, people can't see their own power. They can't see it because it's hidden from them by propaganda and by sort of cultural practices, cultural norms. We're always deferential to people who have fancy clothes and fancy houses. But sometimes organizers try to break that deference. And the best example, in my view, are the Wobblies. Solidarity, remember the song? It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the railroads. What is that about? That's about telling people that they are major actors in social relations. And that's the first step toward a vigorous, effective social movement.
So everybody has power, but some people have more power than others by virtue of how they're situated in the workplace or in the economy. Do you want to say a little bit?
But also by virtue of the fact that people think they have power. That's the point that I'm making now. It's also true that there are circumstances which make it easier for them to exercise their power. It's also true that, you know, most ordinary people are afraid of trying to test their power. And they're afraid of those who wear the ermine robes and crowns and things. That's all true. A lot about culture imprisons us and separates us from our sources of power. But we do sometimes recognize that power. And there are efforts repeatedly through history of people trying to see their own power and then use their own power. I did this a few months ago. I went through the Little Red Songbook, and a lot of the language is about telling people that, yes, they have power. Yes, they have power. Do organizers do that, Deepak?
They should. That should be the main conversation they have with people.
But they have to all do more than just tell them they have power. They have to tell them what the character of that power is, what the expression of that power, what forms it could take. They have to show them.
Okay, time for a little musical interlude. That song Francis quoted earlier was Solidarity Forever, written in 1915 for the industrial workers of the world. It's been a beloved labor anthem ever since. Here's the great British musician Billy Bragg singing it at a rally for striking Starbucks workers last year.
Oh, the union's inspiration, no workers' blood shall run. There shall be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. For what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of none? That the union makes us strong. Let's hear it. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever.
So you talked about the Wobblies as one example. Can you give us some other examples of when that kind of power was realized?
Every big strike is an example of that kind of realization of power. I know you asked me to talk about the welfare rights movement. Just thinking about that movement introduces a kind of complication because, and maybe it's a complication that is very instructive. Welfare rights, this was a movement of poor, mainly women of color, demanding benefits that they were actually entitled to, but typically did not receive. They had a kind of revelation when they would gather in the welfare offices and they would say that they weren't leaving until they got their full benefits. Or it might be that they were doing this for a particular woman who had not gotten her welfare check. But it was a big experience. But the little to do in the welfare office was not, in fact, the disruption that made the welfare rights movement effective. What made it effective, and effective in the sense that it caused a redistribution of public monies in the United States, the amount of money spent on welfare greatly increased. It was the disruption caused by the fact that lots of women were doing it in lots of cities. That's what was disruptive. That caused pressure on municipal and state budgets and pressure on the federal government as well. So, yeah, there were these little disruptions in welfare offices that were, for me personally, because I was often there, I gloried in them. I thought they were wonderful. But that wasn't the real disruption. The disruption was the spread of these actions to the extent that they actually caused a redistribution of public wealth in the United States. That was the disruptive thing.
So you're kind of getting at one of these questions we're going to ask you, Francis, which is when people think about disruption, they often think about protest, but really not all protests challenge the system. So what makes something disruptive?
Shutting it down. It's just what people think makes it disruptive. Now, some shutdowns are much more effective at changing society than others. It's not just being noisy, obviously, causing traffic to back up and stuff like that. But look at it this way. Every important endeavor in our society and in most societies is, in a sense, a cooperative effort. Even if people are snarly and nasty about it, they don't like doing it, it still requires cooperation. Now, for that cooperation to be effective at building a house, at educating children, at curing cancer, for it to be effective, all sorts of people have to do certain things. They have to do what's required for the chemotherapy to work. They have to do what's required for the little kids to go to kindergarten. You can stop doing what's required. Now, we would prefer if what people stop is not the kindergartens, if what they stop are the munitions factories, and we can try to work on that. But everybody can stop something. Everybody.
So the question is, though, how do you get people to stop things together collectively? And that connects to this relationship to organizations, because you've said that disruptive movements may lead to organizations, but rarely do organizations lead to disruption.
That's right.
How do you organize that disruption?
Well, maybe the issue is the permanency of the organization. Here's the problem. Organizations eat resources. They need a budget. They need to rent a place. They need to pay their executive director and then the associate's executive director and the associates to the associate executive director. They need money. They need access. They need to be accepted, acknowledged. They need the mayor to point them out sitting on the dais. They don't get those resources unless they're cooperative over the longer term. The only reason that they get the resources in the first place is because they are keeping things quiet. They're keeping people in line. You know, why do you think the big automobile companies recognized the fledgling United Auto Workers in the 1930s? because they needed a mechanism to keep people quiet because the wildcats were taking over the industry. So they invented a solution, which everybody thinks came from the ground up. The solution was give unions the authority, sign contracts with them so that they had the authority to organize production. Now, there's a terrible dilemma here. I'm not against unions. Unions keep a kind of balance in the distribution of American wealth or anybody's wealth. And if it weren't for unions, the maldistribution, the skewing of American resources would be much worse. Nevertheless, the unions depend for their role, for their contract, on the fact that they are the agents of obedience in the factories, in the places of production. We have to live with that tortured situation. Sometimes we're going to break the contract, and we have to do that with as much troublemaking as we can. But it does mean that if the first thing the boss offers you is a contract with a no-strike clause, you got a problem.
So some people who are critical of these disruptive movements will say, like welfare rights, will say, well, they're great while they last, but eventually they lose steam, and then there's kind of a backlash. So it's like a racist, sexist backlash to welfare that led to Clinton's terrible welfare bill, and then all those gains get wiped out. So how do you think about this problem of backlash to the gain?
Well, you have to try to survive the backlash and then do it again. I mean, there's no permanent solution to the problem that the property classes want to stomp on people at the bottom. And people at the bottom have to rise up again and again and again. You can imagine a permanent solution. Maybe we will have a socialist paradise one day. That would be nice, but not now. It's not happening now. And that means that we have to be prepared to rise up again and again and again.
So where do you see the role of electoral politics in all of this?
Electoral politics is absolutely crucial. The idea that the electoral path and the movement path, there's two separate paths, never the twain shall meet. That was a sort of 1960s idea. It's completely wrong. It's just wrong, factually, historically wrong. The great victories that movements win are crafted and cemented in electoral politics. The movement's pressure is realized in electoral politics. Moreover, electoral support allows the movement to grow. How else would it happen that there was an automobile workers' movement as powerful as the movement that took over Flint, if not that the governor of Michigan was sympathetic to labor, and that FDR, not so sympathetic FDR, but at least worried. So it's electoral support that provides the rhetoric, the definitions of what's happening that allows the movement to acquire public support and to grow. And it's electoral support that ultimately delivers the concessions that are the movement's yield, its result, its victory, its fruit.
So it's kind of like a call and response. The movement needs somebody to respond to it.
Yes, it's call and response, but it's also true that the movement does things that electoral politics by itself would not be able to do. The movement raises issues that an electoral operator will shun because they're trying to win a majority. We can't get along with just electoral support. That'll be very wishy-washy support because electoral operatives are out for majorities. Movements are not.
I guess I'd like to look a little bit at today. And as you kind of look at the landscape, where do you see the hope and possibility for disruptive movements? What's
Oh, I think there's a lot of hope and possibility for disruptive movements. What I'm not so sure of is that it will solve the climate crisis, the disease pandemics, and so forth. The way in which globalization has exposed the dominant systems in our society to disruptive movements is unbelievable. And the fact that nobody is talking about it and strategizing about it is also unbelievable to me. You know, the little bits of work that are from time to time done on logistics and the way in which you can take advantage of the vulnerabilities created by logistical problems to win labor battles. That's what the whole thing is about now. It's all about that because of the extended chains of production, the incredible dependence on fragile systems of communication and transportation. I don't understand why nobody is strategizing about that.
Can I follow up on a tension that might be interesting to explore, which is when you speak about looking for like weak points in the supply chain, those are often relatively skilled and privileged workers, maybe, you know, dock workers or people in manufacturing. It's a relatively small number of people. It's often more likely male. So that's one kind of disruption. And then the other kind of disruption is kind of a mass scale, people refusing to cooperate. And I think, you know, you're in support of both of those things, but I'm wondering how you think about them intersecting for, you know, coming together.
Well, it's a problem. It's an age-old problem, isn't it? It's the problem of the aristocracy of labor. It's a problem of those people who in the 19th century always wore hats when they had their picture taken. The carpenters, for example. So we plead with our brothers and sisters who are better positioned than us to respond to both our anguish and our hope. And sometimes they do.
Well, then taking this broad view, like we have these threats to democracy, growing authoritarianism, as you said, climate crisis, like all kinds of scary stuff happening everywhere. So what would you say to activists today, organizers, where should they be? What's our priority?
We should do what organizers have always done. We should look for the hot spots, keeping in mind that the hot spots are part of systems that are extraordinarily complicated and fragile as never before.
So poor people and other groups without power can't kind of play by the rules. They can't lobby their congresspeople. Why? Why won't these things work for them?
Because their power, they don't have the kinds of power that are called for in lobbying, for example. They don't have big pots of money. They don't have nice clothes. They don't have connections. Those are all the things that will defeat them. And sometimes you see organizing efforts that try to imitate those resources, the holding of those resources. And in fact, a lot of community organizing is like that. We're going to form a group, then we'll form another group, and we'll have meetings. And we will testify. But if that's all you do, it won't matter. It won't matter. Because you can't do as much of that as well as the highly resourced in the society can do. You just can't.
Well, I'm just thinking about your career in organizing, writing, and you've seen some really highs and lows and won some major gains. And I'm just curious what you would think stands out as like highlight memories for you of, you know, moments where you really felt like, yeah, this is it. This is why I'm doing this work.
Well, my father was a product of the socialist movement that swept the area of the Pale in Tsarist Russia. And I was very devoted to my father, partly because everybody else in the family was pretty awful. And from the time I was like 4 or 5, I sort of trotted behind him and I wanted to know things. So my father said, for example, "You can't believe the capitalist press." I couldn't read yet, but I said, "Well, why do you read the newspaper?" And he said, "I read between the lines." I tried to read between the lines for a year. I couldn't do it. No, but seriously, I was serious. I wanted to see what he could see there because I couldn't see anything.
That's a nice memory.
That's amazing. So I read a lot of what you've written. And one thing I think people don't pick up on that you write about is like the role of fun in movements. Can you talk a little bit about that? Joy, just like, I don't know, the ecstasy of when it's, you're in it. That, you know what I mean? That part of what you write about.
Yeah, I know. How can you not write about that? How can you not think about that? There's so much exuberance, so much sexuality in movement activism. I can't separate it from the politics. It is a motivation, a powerful motivation. Isn't that obvious?
So, Frances, you're known for having a lot of skepticism of organizations, but you actually do talk about the positive role of organizations in movements, like the role of the Communist Party and what it did around evictions and unemployment organizing in the 1930s, or the role of welfare rights organizers and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the civil rights movement in the 1960s. So what makes an organization useful to movements?
Well, it's both things. I say that organization, the fetish, preoccupation with building organization, turns activists and organizers away from the good work they could do in building up the momentum of the movement and its capacity for defiance. So they are busy getting people elected as associate vice president of silly things. And I believe that I've seen that so much. And it's also true that they spend money that is very scarce on that kind of thing. On the other hand, it's also true that organizations have some capacity for moderating repression, for example. Organization can be very useful and helpful in crafting legislative answers to the pressure of movements. You know, can't you deal with both things? You got to be a little complicated, because the world is.
I love that answer. Yeah. So Frances was among the first teachers of our class on power and strategy, which the book was based on. And she totally wowed our class and impressed upon them the importance of real disruption. So it feels just amazing to come back at the end of this process of writing the book and working with all these organizers to have this conversation with you. So thank you, Frances.
It's a pleasure to have you as friends and interlocutors. And I hope we continue to do that. And I hope we have the opportunity to talk about more forward-looking strategies. But now is a time to defend ourselves. I'm very much in favor of defending ourselves by having good friends and good food.
So, Stephanie, can we debrief that conversation? I leave every conversation with Frances provoked and a little unsettled, in a good way, I think.
Yeah, she is so insightful and always brings us back to really important ideas about organizing.
So, first of all, I think if you take what Frances has to say seriously, it challenges a lot about what we think we know about social change. I've always been a believer that slow and steady wins the race, but Francis argues that really big change happens in short bursts of time. And I find her critiques of organizations that they can be sometimes more concerned with self-preservation than with big social change, that they can actually slow down disruption at times, to be hard truths. How do you feel about what she has to say about unions? She supports them, obviously, but she stresses that workers' movements lead to unions more than unions create worker movements.
Yeah, there's an element of truth to that. Unions can get bureaucratized, and their leaders are afraid to take risks, and sometimes unions even block movements from happening. But I don't want to miss the fact that unions can, in fact, help foster the conditions for building movements, kind of like what we heard from Greg Nomaker about the role unions have played in Minnesota, or the role that Fight for 15 union leaders had in supporting the protests for Black Lives in Ferguson, Missouri, or the way that unions in other countries have played a big role in helping foster democracy movements.
So another provocation for me is that we talk in the book about how disruption is a key tool for underdogs, but we're using it less and less effectively than in the past. Does that seem like the right diagnosis to you?
Yeah, we mentioned earlier that there's new research by scholars such as Zeynep Tufekci and Erica Chenoweth, which shows that protests are less effective in achieving their demands than in previous eras for a variety of reasons. And the journalist Vincent Bevins has written about massive disruptive protests around the world in the past decade, like in Egypt, Hong Kong, and Turkey, and has shown that in most cases, the outcome was no better, and in fact, often worse. Basically, overdogs have gotten much more sophisticated and effective at blocking disruption altogether or co-opting it, whereas underdogs often lack the kinds of organizations and strategy to leverage disruption effectively.
And what I find most worrisome is the possibility that overdogs may be using disruption much more effectively than underdogs. Of course, overdogs have always used disruption, but if you consider things like the use of technological surveillance and organized disruption of popular movements, like the Russian use of misinformation to sow discord in the Women's March, or things like January 6th when an armed mob actually stopped the counting of the electoral votes, I'm worried. And we haven't even talked about the disruptive potential of AI.
Even though, and because it's so provocative, we are grateful to Francis for teaching us so much about organizing in general and reminding us that all of us always have the power of non-cooperation. Oppressive systems can only work as long as the majority of people participate in the system. In our book, we offer several tools to think about using disruption strategically. One of these, Tool 15, helps groups think about finding strategic choke points. Tools 16 and 17 help think about ways that organizations can fan the flames of disruptive actions to help them spread to disruptive movements.
Disruptive movements can work best in times of rupture, when the dominant system is faltering, or in times of rapid change. More people may be willing to question their participation in a system that is not working. We think we're in a time of rupture right now. Racial neoliberalism is no longer taken to be the common sense. That system is being challenged from both the right and the left. And the coalition of allies that supported racial neoliberalism is starting to come apart. The climate crisis, war, and economic inequality are fueling the fire. What will emerge out of this rupture remains to be seen. But we think disruptive movements may have a bigger role to play in the coming years. Some other strategies, like insider policy work or litigation, in an era where the courts have been captured, are proving less effective. In such a context, disruption becomes all the more important. So let's talk about what's on the next episode. Disruptive movements are likely to succeed and be sustained when everyday people are questioning the status quo, when the dominant social order loses legitimacy. But how do narratives change? For example, how do we go from 27% of people in the country supporting same-sex marriage in 1996 to 71% supporting same-sex marriage in 2023?
In the next episode of Practical Radicals, we'll be joined by two guests. Our colleague, Christina Jimenez, will discuss the strategy of narrative shift. and Alan Jenkins, professor of practice at Harvard Law School and co-founder of the Opportunity Agenda, will help us dig into the theory and practice of narrative change.
What are the stories that are in people's heads about what is just, what is unjust, what can be changed and what can't be changed, and how those things that can be changed should be altered?
Practical Radicals is made possible with support from the Roosevelt Institute. Harry Hanbury and Peter Kakoma produced the series, and Peter Kakoma is the series editor. Our theme music was composed by Christian Perez Yates and performed by Trio Gafas, with additional music by Christian Perez Yates. If you enjoy the show, please follow and rate the show on your podcast app and share it with friends. And join us next time for more practical and radical strategies to change the world.